a trading perspective, understanding that there is a evolution when it comes to trading. You're not going to be successful on day one. The way that you trade on day one is going to be very different than the way you trade after 20 years. And be aware that there is a progression and don't try to fight it, right? Don't try to move too quickly along that path. You want to dance with the music. You don't want to go ahead of the music and you don't want to fall behind.
Hello and welcome to the AlphaMind podcast. My name is Stephen Goldstein and my co-host is Mark Randall. The AlphaMind podcast is the first podcast which looks exclusively at the mindset and psychological aspects of what is needed to achieve outstanding trading performance. And today we are delighted to have one of the world's top, and that is no exaggeration, one of the world's top hedge fund managers speaking with us today. His name is Garth Friesen. He is the CEO of Triple I Capital, based in Florida, which oversees around $6 billion worth of capital. Garth has had a long and distinguished career, starting out as a trader working for Merrill Lynch, both in London and New York, and also working for UBS, before moving into the hedge fund world some 20 plus years ago. Garth also served on the Fed Advisory Committee on Financial Markets alongside some of the great names of trading, including Louis Bacon, Mohamed Alarian, Alan Howard, David Tepper, and many others from the top table of the financial markets business. Garth also wrote an outstanding book on his journey into trading and the general trading journey that people face, how they get into the industry, and what happens when you're actually there. And it has many fine stories and anecdotes. It's called Bite the Arse Off a Bear. It's a great read. And we'll ask him some questions about that as well. This is an excellent interview. Garth shares so much wisdom and insight. There's something for everyone, from the private retail trader right up to the largest hedge fund manager working with billions of dollars worth of capital. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this.
Well, audience, welcome to this further podcast that AlphaMind are running. And perhaps, Garth, just to for the benefit of the podcast audience, really, it'd be great if you could tell us more about yourself, your journey so far, which I'm sure is ongoing, and how you got to where you are in this fascinating career of yours.
Sure, thanks, and thanks for having me on. So currently my role is the CEO of Triple I Capital Management. We're a hedge fund based in Florida. We manage approximately $6 billion of assets across fixed income, credit, some multi-asset portfolios. And I've been here at this firm for, God, it's like 21 years now. Prior to that, I was working on Wall Street. I spent a little bit of time at one of the big banks in New York. I worked at Merrill Lynch. Then I spent 4 years in London working for Merrill and for UBS. And so it's really been a long journey over the course of, you know, my 20 plus years in the markets, going on 25 years in the markets. I've pretty much traded everything under the sun. I started out as a market maker trading Italian lira swaps, moved to trade proprietary trading a variety of different products. So I've had sell-side experience, and then I moved to the buy-side in 1998. And here at Triple I, I've traded treasuries, I've traded mortgages, I've traded interest rate derivatives, options. And in 2004, 2005, I made a switch over to start a credit business for us. And so I got into the credit market. So over the last 25 years, I've pretty much touched all forms of products and markets. And so it has been an interesting journey.
Yeah, I imagine the credit period from 2005 onwards was pretty interesting.
Yeah, particularly 2007 and 2008, it was trial by fire. But you know, it was interesting because I had never traded credit before. But you know, a lot of the there was a lot of similarities to what we were doing on the interest rate side. So the analysis was pretty much the same. It was really a question of just learning the products, learning some of the nuances. But yeah, going through that 2007-2008 experience in the credit market was I guess you could call it the highlight of the career, but you know, it was definitely I think a trying period for everybody that was trading, whether you're in credit or any product.
For sure.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. So we might come back to you, because that period I think is one of the periods which, you know, people are going to be talking about for many decades to come. So perhaps that theme will come up again. I'm sure it will come up again.
We'll make
in
it
this chat.
Again.
Just to,
I still have nightmares of it. I wake up every once in a while thinking that it's 2007, 2008.
Oh boy!
But it's interesting. It's interesting how that period still frames discussions for a lot of people. Certainly for risk analysts, mm-hmm. and risk when you're doing risk assessments, is always like, what could happen? And that's a benchmark. It's going to be a benchmark for decades of, you know, what can happen to a market when people are not prepared. So I think rightfully so, people will be talking about it.
It's interesting because, you know, I often like to think, you know, in my work as a coach, it might sound quite dramatic, but this job is often one long series of traumas. And I think that period was one which for many people was a huge trauma.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah. So, but just to introduce myself and Mark to anyone listening to this podcast who has never heard any of our previous podcasts, my name is Stephen Goldstein. I work as a performance coach with traders and investment professionals, and I've been doing so for about 10 years now. Before that, I was a trader myself, working for investment banks, starting in the mid-80s. In London, I worked for Credit Suisse and Commerce Bank and American Express, and a short spell at Standard Chartered, trading the FX and rates markets. And I was in various roles, some were sell-side market-making roles, but I also had, I would say, most of my time in proprietary trading roles within banks. Mark, maybe you could just tell the audience a bit about yourself.
Sure. Was in markets for close to 40 years. Day one trader, pit trader on life as it began in London, broker for NatWest that became Greenwich Capital in the 90s, RBS later on, so very much on the sales side, but the creative brokerage side of the business. But also I'd practiced mindfulness to deal with myself from the mid-80s and survive and thrive in hugely volatile environments that, as we've just heard, that can creep up on you suddenly. And I was able to position that in the business as a mind fitness training based upon the US military model that just really expanded to the point of I was given retirement and told to essentially open up a business because this particular bank wanted to be my client. And I now face complex working environments, trading environments with this mind fitness model.
It's a form of mindfulness, but you give it a term, military grade mindfulness.
Yeah, it's not the fluffy end. This is very much around managing self in real life, real time, complicated environments where high performance is absolutely necessary, as much as can be necessary at all time.
Okay, brilliant. So that's about us. And now we're going to get back to Garth, our guest today. The first question I want to ask you is, you wrote a book called Bite the Ass Off a Bear, although I think in American English, you'd call it Bite the Ass Off a Bear. It was a great book. I read it. I loved it. Perhaps you could just tell the audience a little bit about that book and what inspired you to write it.
Yeah, so I wrote the book a couple of years ago. And, you know, at that point, I'd been already pretty deep into my career, but I was always asked by people, like a lot of, I think what you do as you've been in the business for a long time is you mentor people, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the questions I was getting asked was, how did you get a start? Like, why you? How did you end up at a hedge fund? You know, particularly because my background was a little non-traditional. I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I grew up in Canada. I didn't have the traditional path into the business nor to a hedge fund. So I thought I would document my story in a book. And at the same time, I wanted to dispel some of the rumors about what people thought of when they think of Wall Street. You know, when most people would use the verbs such as greedy or arrogant, entitled, connected, immoral, you know, the media's done a good job of negatively branding our industry, unfortunately. But I think the reality, and you guys have been in the markets a long time, you know, for the people who have lasted, you know, I would use, you know, adjectives more like, you know, hardworking, honest, dedicated, intelligent, ethical. So I wanted to write the book to, to kind of tell my side of what I see and not to necessarily what the Wolf of Wall Street represents. And finally, I wanted to help guide some people who are thinking about a career in finance to better understand what that career really entails. Many people get into the business for the wrong reasons, you know, thanks in part to those stereotypes that I mentioned earlier, but a trading career is not right for everybody. And giving people an understanding of the real day-to-day could encourage them to enter into the career, or equally valuable to somebody, dissuade them from going into the career so that they don't waste precious time. So that was the real, there was multiple motivations, but the real was just to tell my story, to try to help mentor people who are looking to get into the business.
And I'm going to come back again to the book a bit later on. And it was interesting what you said about some of the qualities of people within the industry, because you know I felt a real humbleness that came out of you and an emotional intelligence as I read the book. And if I'm honest, those are two qualities which I notice in many of the most successful people in this industry, which again runs counter to the traditional media presentation of this industry and its people.
Well, no doubt you're going to find people that are, you know, do represent those characteristics that the media portrays. You know, if you've worked on a Wall Street desk, you've seen it. Those aren't the people that necessarily last, and it's there. Right, right. And to some extent, it takes a little bravado to just put yourself in that situation. But, you know, getting in the door, and this is part of the theme of my book, is getting in the door is only half the battle, right? You know, succeeding once you get there is the real test. And yep. I think some of those factors, they're not the ones that sustain you throughout a career. They may be the ones that make you stand out and get the job. It's not the ones that make you keep it.
And yet, Garth, you had a very interesting story about how you got into the industry.
Oh, you're probably referring to the story in my book, what is now known as the famous interview story. And
that's the one.
You know, you can imagine. Yeah, this was trying to get a job on out of MBA onto Wall Street, and you know the big Wall Street firms, they all came to recruit, you know, like they do a lot of bigger universities and colleges. And you know, the setup for these interviews are pretty standard, right? There's everybody mails in their resumes, they pick 20 people, they send two representatives from the firm, and it's just back-to-back 20-minute interviews. Like you walk one room to the next, and then you're out. And a lot of times, out of the 20 people, they'll maybe only select two or three to go to the next round of interviews at the headquarters, whether it's New York or London or wherever they're trying to recruit from. And, you know, there's a... one of my interviews was with Merrill Lynch. This is where I ultimately ended up starting the career. And I just remember at the time, it's just like, there's a lot of pressure on yourself. This was one of three firms that I really wanted to nail. And after you've been through a number of these interviews, you pretty much have an idea of what it's going to entail, right? What courses have you taken? Tell me something about yourself. You know, there's pretty much standard questions. Every once in a while, they'll throw in a curveball that, you know, either you're prepared for or you're not. But you still only have a 20-minute window. And I was prepared going into the Merrill interview. I had all the list of questions that they could have possibly asked or what I thought they were going to ask. And, you know, I walk into the room and there's the guy sitting on the other end of the desk. And he just looked like a cocky guy right from the minute I saw him. He had his feet up on the desk. He held my resume in his hands. And I walk in, I sit down, introduce myself, shake his hand, I sit down. And he looks at the resume and he's looking back at me and he goes, so you think you're some sort of a tough guy? And I'm like, I wasn't really prepared for this question. And I'm like, why do you say that? And he said, oh, I see here you've got karate on your resume. I'm like, oh, yeah. And I give the answer as, yeah, it's good exercise. You know, it's good discipline. You know, the martial arts helps, you know, training of the mind and body. And he goes, have you ever had to use it? I'm like, what do you mean, had to use it in a competition? He goes, no, have you ever had to use it in a fight? And I'm thinking to myself, it's like, where's this going, right? It's like, I thought we were here to talk about, you know, why I want a career at Merrill Lynch and why I want to trade markets, but he just wouldn't let it go. And I said, well, I've had to use it once or twice. He's like, well, tell me a story. Like, and so here I am, I'm going into a story about how on one weekend in a resort town. We were out, and you know, it's 2 a.m. We're all leaving the bars at the end of the night, and ended up in some sort of an altercation with somebody. And halfway through the story, it's like, what am I doing? Right, I'm 10 minutes into a 20-minute interview, and you know, I'm telling about how I got in a fight at 2 a.m. with some guy. And, you know, by the end of that story, there was about 3 minutes left where I just tried to cram in everything else I wanted him to know about myself. And I thought when I left, it's like, I'm never going to let that happen again. How did I get myself into this situation? You know, I should have taken control of the interview. And, you know, in the lens of looking back at it, I realize, you know, for anybody who has done these interviews, the truth is, like, they're not necessarily fun to do, right? Traders would rather be trading than interviewing other people. And when you're going to a school like this, where it's a mass interview setting, where you're going to meet 20 people inside of 8 hours, and you're sitting there, the main goal is to be remembered, right? Because what happens is that these two people, they've met 20 people, they're taking the train home or they're driving home together, however they're getting back to the office, they're going to sit around and talk. It's like, well, who did you like out of these 20 people? And the truth is, a lot of people are just unmemorable, right? You just, their story's all the same. They're all answering the questions in the way that I was going to answer them, right? But the fact that I kind of lit this guy's day up a little bit with an entertaining story made me memorable. And it allowed me to get invited back to that second round of interviews where, you know, truth be told, I was just as qualified as the, you know, a lot of other people that were being interviewed. But just the discussion that we had, you know, the story just allowed my resume to float to the top when it comes to getting a call back. And so, you know, I learned a few things about, you know, the whole interview process. And I still think that the reason why I put it in the book is not to tell the story about, you know, drunken fights, but to, you know, highlight the importance of being unique and memorable in an interview setting. And I know it's a nervous situation for a lot of people, but you have to stand out in some way so that, you know, when, you know, your resume's on that table with, you know, 19 other people, that they reach for yours. And a lot of that is just having, I think, a personal connection in some way with the interviewer. Yeah. So it's, anyway, it's a bit of a long story, but it does have a point. And I think it does have a bit of insight for people who are going through these interview processes that, yeah. You know, you obviously you want to get your information across, but it's more important to stand out in some way.
Well, you know what? I'm in this industry because in 1986, I was going for a trading job or a job on the trading desk at a Japanese bank in London. And a couple of days before the interview that had been set, I had to have a minor procedure on my toe. It's called an ingrowing toenail, which meant they had to cut off the edge of my toenail and they had to bandage it up. And they said I wasn't allowed to wear a shoe. So I had to wear like a sandal or a flip-flop.
I can only imagine.
Yeah. Oh, so no. I walked into this interview with a suit and one nice smart work shoe and a sandal. And I swear that's why I got the job. The Japanese guys who were interviewing me were killing themselves laughing. As I will
you stood out like a sore toe.
perfect.
Yes. Yeah.
You've got to have stories. Stories are so damn powerful.
Yeah. I might not be sitting here had I not had that ingrowing toenail operation.
It's so true.
Even now.
So true.
So, listen, that's been great. A question which I normally start the podcast with, which is, what three things do you wish you had known at the start of your career that you now know?
That is a good question. I would say the most critical is, and these are easier things to say than to do. But as performance coaches, you'd recognize this. But I would say an appreciation for patience is number one, and that's not just patience with your trading style. It's patience with performance. you know, meaning that it takes time to develop some of these skills that, you know, if you look over a span of 25 years in the markets, you show up on day one and you're green, you're expected to know, you think you know more than you do, and as such, you're expected to perform better than you should. And so I think just allowing a little more patience early in the career would take some of the stress away from, I got to get it right, I have to make money this month, I have to know everything right away. So I think patience with performance is one thing. And I think from another perspective, it's patience with the opportunities. What I've seen in the past, and this is a little bit my experience, but I'd say it's also people that I've seen as well. They're in such a rush to succeed and such a rush to get more P&L, such a rush to get a promotion, that they end up with too much responsibility too early. And that can be a huge negative, which actually destroys a career because, mm-hmm. you know, getting too much responsibility too early doesn't set you up for success. And, you know, in the worst case scenario, you can get managed out of an organization if you repeatedly fail, right? Like this business is about failing, right? And it is ultimately you have to overcome that because we all lose money from time to time. But if you get that responsibility where you're expected to perform at a certain level before you're just capable, whether it's mentally capable, whether it's just from an experience perspective, you haven't learned enough. I think that is something that, you know, now what I try to teach people is that to look at the long road and not look at, you know, what things are happening on a day-to-day basis. So that would be a couple pieces of advice.
Okay. That was great. Anything else? I don't know whether that counts as three or two. I think there was one or two there, but
two good ones.
Two great ones. Yeah.
Well, the other would be the importance of looking at what you're doing outside of just you. Like people think that trading is a solo sport. Sometimes it's like when people think about trading, it's like you in front of the screen, you against the market. But really, there's a lot more that goes into being a successful trader. And, you know, that's an understanding of what you're trying to accomplish. Clearly, you're trying to accomplish money by investing or trading, however you're approaching the markets. But, you know, really what you're trying to do is you're a part of a business. You have other stakeholders, whether it's the firm that you work for. What are their goals? Appreciating that. What are, if you're working on the buy side, what are your investors' goals? It's dealing with the counterparties that you trade with. Most of my trading has been with over the counter, meaning it's not just on screens. They're not anonymous people that I'm trading with. I'm calling people on the phone and I'm asking them to take risk that I don't want. And, you know, forming relationships with people early, you know, is so critical. And it doesn't have to be, and this is part of the other stereotype, that it's win-lose. And I remember when I first started on Wall Street desk, that's what it felt like. It was like, I'm going to win, you're going to lose. I'm going to do a trade, I'm going to make money, you're not. And that's the wrong approach to take. It's that everybody can trade and still be successful. Somebody doesn't have to lose for somebody else to win. And so I think that would be something. It took a little bit of time to learn, but I had a good mentor early on that, you know, taught me that there's more to just trading to being successful, and that's treating it like a business, and that's keeping all your stakeholders happy. Not, you know, P&L is only part of the expectations. The other expectations is, you know, operating in a business-like manner.
Yeah, I think that very much came out in your book, that sort of compassion for others, you know, that sort of that empathy and that emotional intelligence side, I guess, like the softer skills. And I think that was a very good point made in the book, that those things now are critical to survival as well as the, you know, the hard skills, you know, the mathematical or analytical skills, the human skills. So don't forget the human skills. Yeah.
Yeah. No, they're important, and it doesn't mean that you have to be nice to everybody all the time. Cool. You can still be, you know, firm with somebody, but I think getting, you know, I think the biggest compliment you could give to a trader is firm but fair, right? Nobody likes people who constantly try to run somebody over when they're doing a trade. But at the same time, you know, you have a fiduciary responsibility and you need to, you know, trade in a way that gives you best execution for your own stakeholders, and including whether it's your fund or whether it's your prop book or whatever. So it's finding that balance, but it doesn't mean that you have to always be the proverbial a-hole, right? Mm-hmm. You can really be, you can approach it in a way that at least in the long run, it's fair. And there are times when that has come back, and had I treated people poorly on the other end of the phone that I'm trading with, there are times where, they bailed me out of something that I needed to get out of, and they wouldn't have done it if I had repeatedly, approached them with, I'm going to extract every penny from you every time we trade.
Yeah, exactly. So, exactly.
But that it takes a bit of a longer term approach to see that not every trade has to be the best execution, right? Yeah. There's a longer term approach to it. But that's also something that takes time to develop.
Okay, brilliant. You mentioned about a mentor in there, and a lot of people who have achieved success have attributed that success to having a mentor in the early stage. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that for you, your mentor.
Yeah, I've had a couple mentors. I had a mentor on the sell side, and then I had a mentor here at III when I came to III. On the sell side, the mentor, if there was one thing that I would say that he did a really good job of, was allowing you to make mistakes, allowing you to take risk. I've seen some people, and the mentor in this case was the head of the desk, and so, the way this was back in the days when there were lots of European currencies, this was 1994 still,
yep.
Where, there's a lira desk, there's a peseta desk, there's a sterling trader, there's a, the Swissy trader. And so everybody reports into one head of the desk. And, he was really good about allowing people to take risk. And I've seen some heads of desks that are just so concerned about losing money that it emotionally takes away people's ability to take risk. And if he's trying to make his budget, he's given a certain budget that he needs to make for the group, he has to get that from each of the different people. And this comes back to the whole business-like approach. And the only way that he's going to make that budget is if he gets people trading. Because, not losing money is not a way that he's going to meet his budget. It may be a way to avoid losses, but he's not going to get to his budget. His budget wasn't zero for the year. And so just that mentality of it's okay to take risk was something that I learned. That was just a requirement. It wasn't something that was nice to do. It was required to do when you're in that role. And so I thought that was pretty helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I call that an it's okay to fail mindset, because I think you need to have that to succeed.
And there were not everybody has it, right? And there were situations. I remember when one day there was he's looking at his risk report, and he saw for a period of 5 days in a row that the Belgian book, or there was a Belgian book there, didn't have any risk on, right? Like, and he can see exactly what the positions are, the size of the positions, the P&L volatility from day to day, and he saw that there was no risk. And he walked up to the trader, and he said, he had a pretty thick Italian accent. Looking back, it was pretty humorous. I'm sure the guy that he said it to did not find it humorous, but he said to him, he said, look, he's just like, today's your day, all right? Like $100,000 P&L, I want to see it. And I honestly don't care whether it's a profit or a loss, but by 4 p.m. today, you'd better be up or down $100,000. And again, I don't care which direction it is, but it's 8 a.m., you better get trading. And the look in the guy's eyes, it's just his eyes popped. It's like, really? Right? It's just, but it just, that was the type of mentality. It's just like, these seats are valuable. They're not there for you to sit there. The expectation is not to not lose money. The expectation is that you got to take risks. So, that's the kind of mentor that, gets you over that hump, especially early on in a career, that means that it's like, it's okay, like you were saying, it's okay to fail, it's okay to take some losses, because the bigger goal is that I have to take risk.
Yes, 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 absolutely. You know, you talked about having a mentor on the buy side as well. And I find that really interesting because, I find a lot of people struggle with the jump from sell side to buy side. But I also see them struggle with the jump, probably even more so, from buy side analyst to buy side trader or buy side risk taker or buy side portfolio manager. That conversion really gets a lot of people. How did you make that leap? And what was your experience of making that change?
Yeah, no, you're right. It is a leap. It is a change. And I think it's because they are completely different roles, right? They're wrapped up in the realm of trading, but they require different skill sets. They're different jobs. The way that I think of it is, when you're on the sell side, you're basically a market maker, right? A lot of times, unless you're a prop trader. But, for most people that are coming from the sell side, your primary job is to make money for clients, and then you have to position your risk around the risk the positions that the clients give you to try to make money from the flows, but also your positioning views. But with as a market maker, you're reactive. You're not proactive. A lot of times you're being told the positions that you have to have, and you're being given to them on albeit on your side of the market, but you are not. You don't have a clean sheet of paper to trade from. Your risk is given to you. When you go on to the buy side, it's completely different. Nobody's giving you risk. You have to find it yourself, and you start with a clean sheet of paper. And so they're different skills. What I've seen over the years is that there are some people that are very good at dealing with the hand that they are dealt. And then there are other people that are better when, they can, take the cards that they want. And so if they're it's a different skill set, and one requires more creativity than the other. I sometimes liken it to the difference between an architect and a builder, right? An architect is creative. They, come up with a broad plan. A lot of times they're unconstrained, and the builder, and so in this case, the architect would be the buy side, and the builder is more of the implementer. They take the plan and they take what's given to them, and they have to try to optimize it. And they can have some discretion alongside what they're trying to do, but it's a very different role. And I think that people who are used to being given positions to trade have a hard time coming to the buy side when the only positions you're given are the ones that you create for yourself. So they're a different role, I think. So I'm not surprised that a lot of people have trouble making that switch.
I mean, I see it a lot. It's interesting what you said because when I was a trader, I actually wasn't very good as a market maker. I didn't like having other people giving me a position that I didn't want. Yet I found it quite easy to prop trade because I liked choosing when I wanted to have risk on and when I didn't, and what sort of risk I had. But a lot of the guys around me in the bank, they were great market makers. It's a real art, and I think people forget or fail to appreciate the difference sometimes. But I think that also catches a lot of people out that have been really good in a market making role and then move on to a buy side role.
Yeah, it does weed people out, and some of these people should have been better staying as a market maker. I would say I wasn't a particularly good market maker myself, right? It was, I think it comes down to, looking back, it was, I'm still not, I wouldn't profess to be a very good short-term trader, right? And I think as a market maker, you're not there to take views for 3 months, 6 months, or a year. You're there to take risk and get out of it in a very short period of time. And so I think being a good market maker coincides with people who have an ability to take more shorter term risk, and it doesn't suit those as well that want to take a longer term view to their trading style. And personally, once I made that, similar to you, when I made that switch from market making to prop trading, that allowed me to lengthen my trading horizon a little bit longer. you know, which was a good thing just for my personality and just the way that I traded and the way that I could, you know, process risk. And then the move to the buy side once again lengthened that trading horizon even further. And so it was, it's about finding that right trading style to match your personality. And, you know, you may have a personality that's inherently suited for market making and not very good for long-term investing, or vice versa. It doesn't make you a bad trader. It just makes you, need to make sure you set yourself up for the highest chance of success by finding the right role that's the right match.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to you in a minute about that personality aspect. We will return to the podcast shortly, but first some insight on AlphaMind. AlphaMind is a collaboration between two market veterans, Stephen Goldstein and Mark Randall. Stephen is a former professional trader who now works as a coach to people and businesses in the financial markets. Stephen sees trading as a dual challenge. The markets challenge, which is the tangible aspect of trading, and the mindset challenge, the challenge to overcome yourself. This is the intangible aspects of trading, and this is where he specializes as a coach. You can check out his and Alpha R Cubed's work at alpharcubed.com. That is the letter R. Or email him, info@alpharcubed.com. Mark Randall has over 30 years working as a professional broker in the industry. Mark used mindfulness techniques to help him optimize his performance as a broker. Later in his career, he was asked to start giving talks, seminars, and workshops to corporate leaders and investment businesses about how to apply mindfulness to work more effectively and productively. If you are interested to know how Mark could help you or your business, he can be contacted at ceo@markrandallconsultancy.com. Now back to the podcast. I know Mark has a question, which I think you wanted to ask off.
To explain the title, Bite the Arse Off a Bear, if you could.
Oh, yeah, so that's an expression that goes back to the 90s, and I think it was Goodfriend from Solomon Brothers in the early days credited with the first to say it, but after that it was adopted, more people used it on Wall Street. But the title of the book came from my own introduction to that saying, which happened when we were all fresh recruits from my all out of MBA school, first year on Wall Street. You go through a training program, right? So they get, before they put you on a desk, they give you some general guidelines in trading, or training for what to expect, what to do. And so you have a 4 to 6 week training program. And you could imagine this room full of type A personalities, everybody sitting there. They're going to be the next guy that's going to come in, and next woman who's going to come in and run the firm. They're going to be the next hotshot. And we're expecting these motivational speakers to come in and, congratulations, you've been selected to be an elite part of this organization. But the first guy that came in was and he was pretty senior in the bank too. I don't remember exactly who it was, but he came in and he just got to the podium at the front of the group. And there was a couple hundred of us there. And he said, everybody look around, look to your left, look to your right. Said, half of you are not going to be here in 5 years, and 90% of you are not going to be here in 10 years. Because if you want to be the one who's lasting after 10 years, you got to wake up every morning ready to bite the ass off a bear. And then he walked off the stage, right? And and typical to people in their 20s, we all looked around. It's like, I feel sorry for those guys, right? you always think it's going to be the other person. But that was the first time I had heard it, and didn't really appreciate it until what it really, we heard it back then, but didn't really know what it means until after you spend a few years in the industry, and you see those numbers come to fruition where people drop off. And you know what? He was right. Half the people left within 5 years, and 90% left within 10 years. And, you didn't believe it at the time, but it's true.
It's very insightful, I'm sure, for the audience.
So let me turn the table on you and ask you a question, since we're talking about this. Is what is your opinion, with your collective experience, on how long it takes for a trader to mature, right? Like, somebody told me that it takes 7 years, when I first came, that it takes 7 years for somebody to mature as a trader, whatever mature means. Maybe let's just define it as being comfortable with what they're trading, how they're trading, and their career. But what is your opinion on how long it takes for somebody to really get their feet under them?
I'll let Steve answer that from the trader side first. Then I'll answer that from the sales side, because I think the answer might be slightly different.
Okay, so I think there's a long time span. Some people mature really quickly in about 3 or 4 years, and some people, such as myself, took a lot longer. I don't think I became a good trader till well into my maybe 13 or 14 years into my career. So in a sense, I'd hung on a little bit in the early days. I had some really good years where I made a lot of money and then thought I'd landed. And then, you know, the market came back and gave me a lesson the following year that really knocked my confidence and gave me a huge wake up call. And, you know, whilst people might think, well, you've been doing this job 13 years, you know, I was called a senior trader. But actually, when I look back on my career, I don't think I was that good at that point. And then I went to a coach. I had a coach, a brilliant coach. I was at Commerzbank then, and it was an experiment. I was given an executive coach. And this experience with a coach completely changed me as a trader. And I suddenly grew up, not literally overnight, but through this process. And I got a chance to reflect, to think about my journey, what I was doing and how I was doing it. And then the next 10 years, I suddenly felt, okay, now I'm a trader. And it seems bizarre to think it took that long. You know, I think that journey varies for so many people. You know, I don't coach. I tend to say that I don't coach people with at least 4 to 5 years experience, because they're on a very sharp learning journey. They've got to kind of learn what to do and what not to do in those days. It's much more directive about learning how to become a trader. And then after that, I'm happy to work with them because, you know, we're into the maturity phase. And that can take anywhere from 5 years to, I know guys who have said, you know, after 20 years of hanging on, I suddenly became good as well.
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's similar to what you're talking about, the way that you can look at professional athletes, right? The first, whenever anybody's picking up a new sport, your first few years, you're just, you know, whether it's golf or tennis, you know, you're just worried about the mechanics. Like, what is this all about? What do I need to do just to be able to do it, right? You're not really focused on strategy as much as you are the mechanics. Yeah. But you look at the athletes that are very developed, and, you know, Roger Federer isn't thinking that he's got to go turn his hand over on the forehand, or he's got to, you know, shift his weight. He's thinking 5 steps ahead. I think it's the same in trading. Is you have to, and it takes time to learn all these different markets and mechanics and how they operate before you can free up mind space to be able to think about the big picture of what you're trying to do. So it does take time. I'd say in my case, it took, you know, 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, I remember when I first started on life as a floor trader, probably the first fast market worked me up a little bit, right? That's when you know, first fast market as a pit trader, you suddenly start to grow up pretty quickly. I thought I then grew up through the crash of 87, because, you know, that was something beyond what we'd ever seen before, and the spreads in the market and the dynamics and the flow that came from that, and also the client demand. So that, and I thought I'd grown up by the early 90s, but then I had another phase of growing up, which was then Greenwich Capital took over the NatWest Markets business. And then it was kind of a different game altogether. And I guess you may have known some of the Greenwich Capital guys, but yeah, we had to grow up pretty quickly with those guys around, because they were seriously in, they knew what they were doing. You know, there was some stuff that they were doing that we had to wake up to, you know, change our game, up our game, realize that we were great. You know, we could do great things, and that helped to sort of a self-belief. And throughout my time, I had an assistant treasurer of the bank that just happened to be, you know, guiding me and nurturing me, and as well as my own personal processes as well that were helping on that journey. So I guess I had a couple of phases of growing up.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did when you were on Life, Mark, did you ever run into Terry Crawley and the BTP?
Yeah, absolutely. I know him from day one, and But I was also trading for some very large European banks during the BTP, and I was probably a pain in his backside a lot of the time for some of the flow I put to that pit. So, yeah, absolutely. And those guys on Life, you know, we had a social connectivity as well. You know, we talked about that earlier. And, you know, the golf society was kind of like the bonding society on the Life floor. And being a golfer, I was kind of like a nobody. I was like, you know, an alternate, you know, just working for a bank. But actually, I was pretty neat at golf, so I got a different type of reputation. You know, and you start to realize that you can create networks that are good sort of professionally, but in sort of an unprofessional sort of way in terms of through sport. And all that was very, very helpful. And you need that network in this type of job. I'm sure you'll agree. You need these supporting networks going on to just help you get through challenging times.
Well, you need a support network, but you also need a network to help you feel confident, right? In
the way that
you're trading. It's just like I can't imagine, having, and people do it and they're successful. It's just you and a screen, right? And all the feedback that you get is from prices without ever talking to people. And I think it's a little more, needed when you're dealing with over the counter products of derivatives or cash bonds, corporate bonds. But, you have to talk to other traders. You have to speak to other people in the industry, and it's just understand, if not to get their opinion, but just to find out how the market's positioned, market pulse, what other, the sentiment out there, which is just as critical as observing prices, is understanding sentiment.
And
one of the ways to get that is by talking to people, right? If you isolate yourself in a room with just a screen, you're I think missing out on some other inputs that can help you at least make decisions, or maybe not better decisions, but hopefully more confident ones.
And as you said, the informality of some of those relationships can have a huge impact on you when you're down. When you asked me about confidence in preparation for this interview. You know, I talked about one of my up periods was 1994, when I made a lot of money in the bond bear market, and I got selected to join the prop desk at Credit Suisse the following year. And it didn't go very well in the first 6 months, and I was losing a lot of money. I was in a really bad place. I couldn't see the wood for the trees. And the head of trading at a bank came up to me one day after about 6 months. And, I'm thinking, oh, God, what's he going to say? I'm down $2 for the year. What could he possibly say? And he just said, look, Steve, don't worry about it. I believe in you. Don't worry about it. You're going to make this back. That was it. That was all he said. And I just went on this run. That was unbelievable. It felt like it happened at that point. I know it didn't. It took a while. But my confidence returned. And suddenly I started seeing opportunities. I started monetizing those opportunities. And, I ended up the year with a small plus, which I never expected at all. It's so important sometimes to have that.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely critical. And, when you're losing money, there are a couple different ways you can lose money. One, you can just get your call wrong, right? And other times you can just make mistakes, right? Like something happened that you should have caught that you didn't. Yeah. And I had a similar experience, and this was on the buy side, where it's trading is stressful, especially if you're dealing in relative value, where you're dealing in multiple different instruments. You have hedge ratios of futures versus swaps and all these different things that are going on, conversion factors in futures. And there was a time when I did it. This was back when I was doing the treasury asset swap book on the buy side, and I screwed something up. I messed up the conversion factor in a futures roll, and I did the wrong amount. And it took me about 30 minutes to realize that I had done the wrong ratio. And I'm sure everybody's had that feeling of just all the blood rushing from your body, and it's just like, oh my God, what do I do? And, and of course, which always happens, the market has moved against you, right? They never move in your favor when these type of mistakes happen. And you know, I quickly identified what the problem was. I went to the portfolio manager, you know, right away, and I said to him, hey, look, I've got a problem. I've made a mistake. I did this, and you know, I should have done that. It's going to cost us $120,000. And he looked at me, and I was just waiting for what he was going to say. He says, okay, go. First of all, go fix it, go correct it, and then we'll talk later. And, you know, sure enough, you know, I made the correction, and I felt horrible, obviously. But he came up to me, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, and I was expecting him to, you know, let me go, right? Maybe that, you know, who knew what was going to happen? And I said, what are you here to fire me? And he said, fire you? It's like, I just spent $120,000 training you. But I'm not going to get rid of you now. And after that, it was, you know, feeling as like, again, it's just like, no, like, he didn't need to tell me to feel bad about making a mistake. I think everybody, you know, it wasn't a cavalier mistake, but it was just the ability to move on from that, which is helpful, because if you're so afraid of making mistakes, and whether it's, you know, whether they lose money or not, then it's just going to lead to inaction. And, you know, we were talking about earlier, this is not a business of inaction. You have to act. You know, sitting on your hands is not what's expected. So, you know, it's true. You know, it goes back to confidence. It's these little things that mentors or people can do to instill, like, I think they go on unappreciated.
Oh, yeah. And this is why I think the working on your own, and I'm pretty sure listening to this podcast, this will be a lot of retail and private traders who do sit at home on their own and perhaps don't realize the value of even investing in having a network. You know, there's some mentoring companies out there, but there's, you know, making the effort to go out, go to some industry events, meet people. It can have a huge influence.
Well, and it's important for professionals that have come out of institutional roles and have found themselves in the retail market now, trading at home.
Yeah.
It's important for them to just make sure that they do make that effort to connect.
Garth, you asked earlier, and I'm mindful of the time, so I don't want to miss out this opportunity. You asked about personality and risk taking. That's really interesting for me, because I when I coach traders, I ask them to take a very simple psychometric called the risk type compass. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Not that one. I'm familiar with a few of them, but not that one in particular.
This is an objective psychometric created by a company called Psychological Consultancy. So it asks a number of questions and you're given multiple choice answers. So it's very hard to game. It produces like a compass with 8 different personality types. And I found, not scientifically, but through sort of unofficial research, some really interesting patterns of success rates in certain roles or trading types match to these different personalities. So you talk about relative value. And what I did is when we first started using this about, it was in 2014, we analyzed a group of traders in banks, hedge funds, energy firms, some private traders, went from various different products. I think we analyzed 69 altogether, and found some really interesting patterns, that they were a certain type. In other words, a certain type would excel in a certain type of trading. And
so what's an example of one of the stronger patterns that you saw? Either the ones that were the pattern that led to success or the pattern that led to failure?
I'm going to give you two of the types. There's a type called the intense type. That's one of the 8 personalities. And they're very passionate. They feel the market very strongly. They're very good at what we would call fast short-term trading. So a lot of the market makers that we met, particularly in markets like FX and commodities, which were really reactive markets, they were really strong in those areas. And then the opposite type to that was the composed, calm type, the guy that can sit there, sit back, not be flustered as something happens. He's not reactive instantly. He likes to think about what's happening. We call that the composed type. We found virtually no spot traders, no market makers in the fast markets. But we found a lot of option traders, a lot of option market makers, a lot of proprietary option traders in that composed type. And they tended to be people that could, that they'd run a portfolio. So they were constantly adjusting the portfolio.
Yeah, managing surpluses, that's different thinking. Yeah.
And it was really interesting. One year I was coaching an FX trader at a bank, an Australian bank, and he was on the spot desk. And I was discussing his personality with him. And he said, he was telling me a story, you know, that, you know, he'd been on the way to work, on cycling to work, and he'd been cut up at the lights by a white van. And the guy got out and started having a go at him. And he just sort of went, yeah, whatever, mate. And the guy was like, well, he wanted a fight. And this guy was completely nonplussed. And he went in and he told all his colleagues on the trading desk. He said, well, didn't you get angry? Didn't you want to punch him? He said, no, the guy's an idiot. All those guys on the desk, they were spot traders. This guy was the composed type. Right. And he was struggling as a spot trader. He wasn't making money because he liked to... You have to react really quick when you're trading spot FX, okay? And actually what had happened is he'd been moved to the options desk because it wasn't working. The bank decided to put him on FX options, and they hadn't really had an FX option trader at that point. And he had no one to show him the ropes. So he was trying to trade it in a spot style. And I said to him, you sound like a classic options trader. You're more composed, you like to think about it, you're not reacting. You know, it's about managing the portfolio positions, you're managing the delta, you're managing the gamma. You know, the actual price at that point is less important to you. And he went, yeah, it's really interesting. He said, that's what I want to do. I said, why aren't you doing it? He said, well, I've got no one showing me the ropes. So from that point on, he started adapting his style to be a traditional options trader. You know, he went over to the interest rate option guys, learned from them. It made a huge difference. He was now trading in a way which was completely compliant to his personality. And I have seen this time and time and time again in my work, where people just, you know, if they've been mentored by someone or somebody to do a job in a certain way, they've not been mentored to do it in a way that's compliant to how they are, they're not as effective, they're not optimal. We've got a cluster of RV and portfolio traders, which we've noticed as being around the prudent type. Prudent, deliberate, you can't see the, I should send this to you in an email afterwards, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm showing it to Mark right now. A cluster of people that are RV traders, and they're all in the same part of this diagram. And these are guys in hedge funds and banks. Then we've got a group of directional traders, which are nearly all on the opposite side.
Carefree and adventurous.
Carefree, excitable, intense, adventurous.
And very interesting work.
This shows up time and time and time again. It's almost, for me, it's like an athlete. You know, if you're built for sprinting, you do the 100 meters. Yeah. If you're long and wiry, you run the long distance events.
That's so true. And I think you might have even answered your own question from earlier of why people have difficulty making that transition from market making to the buy side is, you know, generally speaking, I would say that market makers are probably more, whether it's spot FX or market making any product, is more in the intense category. And on the buy side, traditionally, you know, it's more composed. And yeah. So it's absolutely true. And I don't know why banks haven't, not just banks, but I don't know why any investment firm doesn't try to identify this and really try to match people. Because, by the way, I think this is another reason why there's such heavy attrition in the industry. We're going to try you in the spot. It's going to work or it's not. And if it doesn't work, you're gone. We're going to get somebody else, as opposed to, you know, you could have a perfectly great resource there that's just in the wrong seat. And I think this is where a really good trading manager, or whether it's a PM or the head of a trading desk, will be able to identify, you know, the strengths and weaknesses and the personality type of the team that they're on or the team that they have, and just get them in the right seat to give them the best chance of success.
There was a guy I coached a few years ago at a large US hedge fund, And he was telling me about when he started in the market. He was hired by one of the big investment banks straight out of university, and they put him on the spot desk. And he said for 2 years he sucked. He couldn't make a penny. And they then moved him to the forward FX desk, which, as you know, it's much more, it's more relative value interest rates than it is spot FX. And he just couldn't stop making money. And he was the prudent type, completely the wrong type to be a spot trader, completely the right time to be a relative value trader. And that always stuck out to me. And even now in the fund that he's at, every now and then he likes to dabble in spots. He just can't help himself, and it always goes wrong.
And just to confirm that he should stay away.
Yes, but he's got this beef that he wants to try and make some profit doing spot. But it's always a side bet.
Well, certainly these graduate programs need to be showing more flexibility to the roles that are there earlier on in the grad schemes than to just plonk someone down for 2 years because, it's potentially a waste, a waste of money if they're the wrong, square peg in a round hole.
I mean,
Very
I could probably do
interesting.
a full podcast on this, but we've seen so many examples over the years, and then it's guys that also matched badly with other guys, so it's if you're going to mentor someone, sometimes it's much better to give them a range of mentors than one individual, so they can learn different styles. And again, banks don't always do that correctly.
And I think one of the other aspects is people tend to be informed or their style by their first experience, right? Like if your first experience on a trading desk is with a certain type of trader, like that for whatever reason, I'm sure there's a behavioral psychology aspect, whether it's framing or whatever it is that would make that as the benchmark to which you're supposed to aspire. And if you early on are tried to or getting put in a particular box, it's hard to get out of that. And this is why sometimes people switch firms. This is sometimes why they switch desks. Sometimes why they switch products. And you could be, you could say the same thing of trading, whether it's spot FX to going to trading credit. Very different type of trading that's required and different analysis. And just because you're good at one doesn't mean that you're going to be good at the other, or vice versa. You could be horrible at one and really, really good at the other.
Mark wants to ask you a question because I.
But I think as we're starting to finish up here, Garth, is to ask you one question that, given your exposure to the Fed Advisory Group, just how interesting that would have been from your perspective of I guess seeing what peers were doing.
Yeah, no, I think it's, just to give a little bit of background on what this committee was, it was formed in 2009 in response to the financial crisis. And what was happening was the New York Fed, who was tasked with monitoring markets, realized pretty quickly that the information that they were getting with their primary source of information up until that point was banks. And clearly the banks were having some issues of their own, and that the information they may have been getting was not 100% accurate or watered down. And so they wanted to reach out to other market participants, buy side participants, in order to start to gather market intelligence. What's going on? What's happening in the CDS market? Why is this taking place? And so they started reaching out to different market participants to get that color. And I happened to, get a call from somebody there who was set up through our coverage at Goldman Sachs, and just started chatting with them about what's going on with the markets without any ex. This is before they started the formal committee. And based on those conversations, they ended up inviting me to join this committee, which was, maybe about a dozen, buy side investors, from hedge funds, from pension funds, from real money allocators. And so it had the likes of Mohamed El Erian and Louis Bacon and Alan Howard. So it was a real privilege to be on this. But I noticed that even amongst, I felt a little bit out of place, to be honest, but with observing this group of 10 high-powered investors, there was still somebody that stood out as being a leader, and that was Mohamed El Erian. And when I define him as a leader, I'm not saying that he had the right market call, right? Or I'm not saying that he was smarter than anybody in the room. Not saying that he was a better trader than anybody in the room. You know, David Tepper probably would have gotten that nomination. But what made him stand out was his ability to communicate. Like, he always spoke very clearly, and he, unlike a lot of other people who had difficulty separating noise from what really matters, he could always synthesize any issue, the European debt crisis, you know, the financial crisis in the U.S., into three issues, and be able to articulate what those three issues are so that anybody could understand. And it was just, you walked away listening, it's like, this is why he is the leader of a lot of the organizations that he's been at. He's just a very good communicator. And so this isn't necessarily, you know, we're talking about trading mentality, but part of leading a trading organization is being able to communicate. What are your thoughts? What are your views? And why? And do it in a few sentences and make it crystal clear. And he had this innate ability to do that, where he was almost seen as the oracle of these oracles. So it was good to see, and I learned a lot from him, the importance of being concise, being clear, and, you know, being articulate. So it was interesting to be part of that.
What a great time. Great. Well, great privilege as well to be part of that type of discussion as well, I'm sure.
Can I don't know if we've run over it. Have you still got a little bit more time?
Yeah, I have more time if you like.
All right, because we've slightly run over, but I did want to ask you about that Fed Advisory Group, because reading your book, you know, that experience that you had then really struck me. There was a story you told about the Greek crisis that literally up to that moment where the ECB acted, no one had a good handle within that group of what was going to happen. It's fascinating for me, because from my time in the bank, my time sitting on a desk, and I saw a lot of people who are listening will think there's always somebody else who knows. There's always people who know what's going to happen. But actually, it's what I've found working with these, you know, very successful traders over the years as a coach, is actually it's the ones that admit they don't know what's going to happen that are often the guys who are the most successful traders. And it also told me that there really is no one out there who knows what's going to happen next. Anyone who does is just, you know, that they're being overconfident in their guessing.
Yeah, no, it's true. I learned a couple things from that incident that, you know, you were referring to in the book, and it was right in the midst of the Greek crisis in Europe, and you know, what was the ECB going to do? What was the way out? And, you know, nobody, you know, everybody had opinions, and everybody had a different level of analysis that got them to their opinion. But like you said, nobody with certainty knew what was going to happen. And it was clear, but, you know, when people, you know, stated their view on what could happen, it was still couched with, this is my best guess, right? It's not, I don't know what's going to happen clearly, but based on what I see, this is likely. And what the other thing I learned from this is when you went around the room and you heard 10 people, which collectively, you know, we're controlling $4 trillion of assets, you know, talk about their views, you would think that their portfolios probably reflect that level of sentiment, that they were all negative, that the worst is going to happen, the world's going to end, the banking system is going to collapse, that, you know, from a positioning perspective, everybody was already short, right? Everybody was already underweight. Everybody had already de-risked. And so that, you know, when you saw what the ECB did with the whatever it takes comment and the way that they worked their way out of that, you know, very thorny political and market issue, the market was caught by surprise. And there wasn't, even being in that room where, you know, everybody had all the best analysts that money could buy, you know, there wasn't an edge, right? Because just happens, right? Like, it was unpredictable. And it was humbling, and it made me feel better, actually. Not that everybody was wrong, but it's just that I didn't have to be right all the time. It's that I didn't feel like I had a disadvantage against, you know, people, you know, who you thought would have possibly had an advantage. It, it, you know, there's it's it, I learned that a lot more of making money in the markets isn't coming from the information you have. It's a lot more about your ability to dial up or dial down risk and control your risk, rather than being, you know, a better call than somebody else.
I think that's a great point. And I think so many people who come into trading don't understand that. When you talk about maturity, as you did earlier on, that is something which you suddenly learn. I'll be honest, I probably didn't appreciate that even 7 to 10 years into my career. And when I started becoming much more successful later on in my career, I got that. I think somewhere unconsciously that became part of my thinking process.
Experience. Yeah, you know, it's like people forget. Yeah, people forget what the end game is. The end game is to produce returns or to make money.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with your batting average, right? It's how much you've managed to preserve by whatever period of time you're looking at. And, you know, I've seen people pound their chests. It's like, you know, 9 out of my last 10 trades have been profitable. You know, I've got a great call on the market. It's like, well, what happened to the other one? It's like, oh, I got slaughtered. Right? I gave it all back. It's like, well, how are you happy about that? You know, the goal is supposed to be, if you lost money on 6 or 7 of them and on 3 or 4, you made more than you lost, then you're in business, right? You don't stay in business by, you know, being right. You stay in business by risk managing and making money.
Completely, completely. Yeah. There's so much wisdom in this last point. You know, it can lead us into areas like ego and, you know, and all these aspects, you know, about the need to be right. Whereas the need is to make money and to preserve money, not to be right. You don't actually get
right. I think that comes back to what you were mentioning earlier about one of the factors, which I think, you know, you've probably seen as well, is that the people that have been around have an element of humility that, you know, exactly. does take some maturation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, listen, Garth.
I've got a question.
Oh, sorry.
I'm jumping in.
Mark is ready with a question.
I'm very interested about the balance of people that are on trading desks. I know that there's a temptation to... from a hiring perspective, to hire your rocket scientists and the guys that can crunch the math, you know, the guys that have got the degrees. And of course, those people tend to be quite siloed in their behavior. Are you starting to see, certainly from your connections, people starting to hire a slightly more diverse audience onto desks, onto trading teams? You know, people that... Okay, you got the Einsteins there, but are you sort of are people starting to throw in a couple of Michelangelos to start to see the market slightly differently? Because, you know, the game's kind of changed. Markets have become very subtle, and yet they're still very complex, and the opportunities are kind of hitting in the edges. Are you starting to see desks change shape yet, or is that starting to happen?
Yeah, I think it's specific by firm. Every firm's got a different strategy. I would say, on average, though, the trend to hiring more quant-driven, more computer-driven, more software expertise, development expertise, that has been happening for some years, and I see that continuing.
Right.
I think it's a function of just the way that markets are behaving now, and that I think you have to have an element of, just to be competitive, you know, from an analytical perspective, you have to be able to be, you know, at an advanced modeling from a financial markets perspective, you know, and that involves understanding data. It understands, you know, the math behind a lot of the models, because, you know, when markets get more efficient, there's a one way to combat that is to, you know, try to get an edge from either an analytical perspective, from a complexity perspective, or from a speed perspective. And all the move towards, you know, the data analysts and the quant analysts that have those skills that can help you to do that, that's, I still see that happening. I'm not sure if it's going to mean that it's going to be successful.
No, sure.
The jury's still out. But I see that trend being, much more. You have a much better chance of getting hired with a data management background than a Michelangelo than an art degree these days. Although, back in the days, I think there was more of an acceptance to have that diversity. I see less diversity now than a trading desk of 20 years ago.
Yeah, I guess the creative side could come through the area like gaming, where it's a blend of the way some of the background technologies are going. There's probably an overlap with trading systems and gaming in terms of trying to find the edge or understanding how to view where the edge might be.
Yeah, no, that could be a source of talent as well. It's probably more likely skill set that the hardcore gamers maybe I think they'd probably make better market makers than they would buy side, just continuing on with the theme that we were talking about. But
absolutely,
yeah, the industry has changed, and it used to be for whatever reason there's a premium that's placed on complexity and people being quote unquote smart, right? And I think that's because markets have evolved. Like when I was at UBS, and there was a guy that traded 2-year notes, right? All he traded was 2-year notes, plus or minus some off the run issues. Every day he came in and he made his budget, he made his money, and he never lost money or rarely lost money when you look at it over monthly or quarterly periods. But all he could do was trade 2-year notes. Right? Like you ask him to trade a swap and he wouldn't know what he's doing, trade an option, no chance, but he was doing his job. He was making his budget. I think in today's world, whether it's because of headcount, constraints, whether it's just because of, the electronification of markets, that type of narrow, but good skill set is no longer needed. And so they're looking for people that can take a skill set that can be applied to multiple different markets or multiple different products, just from an efficiency perspective. And that drives to more software type solutions or programming solutions.
Interesting. Fabulous.
Okay. Now I'm going to try and wrap it up again. Okay. Listen, this has been great, Garth. Can I just ask you for one little nugget of wisdom that anyone who has stuck through this entire podcast can take away with them?
So when it comes to the career perspective, or don't get down on yourself if you're not initially successful. And it comes back to what we were saying before. It's take the time up front. And whether this is you go into trading or go into any career, in trying to match your personality with the role that you end up with in the investment world, whether it's an execution trader, whether it's a prop trader, whether it's a market maker. And so invest up front in really trying to understand yourself and what you have a better likelihood of doing that will be successful versus, you want to swim with the tide as opposed to against the tide. And from a trading perspective, this is maybe a more nuanced nugget, but understanding that there is a evolution when it comes to trading. You're not going to be successful on day one. The way that you trade on day one is going to be very different than the way you trade after 20 years. And be aware that there is a progression and don't try to fight it, right? Don't try to move too quickly along that path. You want to dance with the music. You don't want to go ahead of the music and you don't want to fall behind. And it's just recognize that's a multi-year process. And, you go from, I remember when I started on day one, it's like I was so concerned about $1,000 P&L up or down, being right or wrong. And over time, you can put it into context that, that's not necessarily the big picture of what you're trying to do. We all are trying to make either a budget or return on investment. And so understanding what the big picture is helps you tolerate the losses, adjust your trading size to be able to manage large amounts of capital, and just to be patient with it and not to give up too early would be my biggest advice.
Fantastic.
That's fantastic. I'll leave it to Mark to take us out of here.
Well, Garth, I think ourselves here at Alpha Mind and Alpha Mind headquarters. would like to just thank you for your time. There's been enormous value and some very, very wise words. So we thank you again for your time.
Thank you to Garth Friesen. I'm sure you'll agree that was so full of wisdom and insight. If you enjoyed this episode, please go and rate this podcast on iTunes. This helps us get greater attention and a wider audience. And if you would like to leave a review, that would also help us. Going forward, we have some great future podcasts coming up. Next week, we will be interviewing Dr. Brett Steenbarger, the world's leading authority on the mindset and psychological aspect of trading and investment performance. Brett has worked for many years coaching some of the world's leading traders, and he has also written several books on the subject of trading, psychology, and mindset. It is a great interview, and you know, if you subscribe to us, you won't miss it. We also have a growing back catalogue of excellent podcasts, which are a great resource for traders and investment professionals from the beginner just starting out to a senior experienced professional at the very top of his game. You can also check us out on social media, where we produce articles and share insights on the mindset challenges of succeeding as a trader. Our homepage is alpha-mind.net. Our blog has a growing compendium of articles, book lists, and lists of other great podcasts for traders. The Alpha Mind blog can be found at alphamindblog.blogspot.com. We are also active on Twitter on @AlphaMind101 and @TheMindGuys. Please also check out our LinkedIn group with over 15,000 members. That group is called the Alpha Mind Group. And we would be delighted if you could connect with myself, Stephen Goldstein, and Mark Randall on LinkedIn. We also plan to start a newsletter soon, so you can sign up for that on the blog page, alphamindblog.blogspot.com. It's been a pleasure to have you listening to this episode. Once again, a huge thank you to Garth Friesen for sharing his perspectives on the mindset of trading and imparting his wisdom. His book, Bite the Arse Off a Bear, is a great read. I highly recommend it. That just leaves me to say good luck in your trading and investing this week, and goodbye.